from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro, in for Dave Iverson. Coming up on Forum, first, what does the Supreme Court ruling on human genes mean for California biotech? And at 9:30, San Francisco is changing. San Francisco is always changing between one gold rush and the next. The worry is too much change, too fast, destroys what we love best about our city and its culture. Ahead of a summit tomorrow, we'll launch a lively chat today on living history. Forum is next. Next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro, sitting in for Dave Iverson. This hour, California's biotech industry prepares to retool after the U.S. Supreme Court unanimously ruled human genes simply isolated from the body can't be patented. Also, a vibrant place like the San Francisco Bay Area is constantly remaking itself. Is there a way to do so without losing the people and places that brought us to where we are today? Past, present, and future, it's all happening on Forum this hour. Joining us now to talk about the future of gene patenting in California and beyond, we have Lauren Sommer, science and environment reporter for KQED Public Radio.
Good morning.
Good morning. And on the phone, Mildred Cho, Associate Director of Stanford's Center for Biomedical Ethics. Thank you for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Well, naturally, I thought, Lauren Sommer, we should start with a simple summary of the U.S. Supreme Court ruling.
Yeah, and so it really centers around two genes, BRCA1 and BRCA2. And these are genes that are important to kind of predict risk when it comes to breast cancer and ovarian cancer. And what happened is one company, Myriad Genetics, has controlled the patents for these genes. And that's given them the right to control the tests for these genes. So if you need that test, you could really only go one place. And that's what was challenged in this case, was whether they could actually patent those genes, whether that was a patent that was really valid. And so the court came out with a decision yesterday that was definitely interesting, and it was maybe actually a little more narrow than people were expecting.
Mildred Cho, would you say this is a legal confirmation of a moral or ethical boundary line that a lot of people in biotech already had? Or was this something that was really up for debate and still is?
Well, I think it was something that was up for debate in that there were many patents that were issued that were very similar to the Myriad patents that were based on this idea of being able to claim something because it's isolated.
Let's talk about isolation. Lauren Sommer, I guess what's called cDNA, isolated in the lab and adjusted in some way, is still legal. That's what the Obama administration was actually arguing for. It's what the Supreme Court ruling appeared to confirm. How much of a change from the regular stuff that's in our bodies allows for a patent?
Yeah, so we're kind of talking about two things here. This is what the court differentiated between. Isolated genes. So these are when they kind of take a gene right out of your DNA and isolate it. And when they do that, they can test it. They can analyze it. That's what the court said. You know, that's not patentable. That's a product of nature. It's found naturally in your body. But as you mentioned, synthetic DNA or cDNA, that's what they said. The patents are still kind of still standing. And what that is they take the gene out, they make a copy of it, and they take out little pieces that they don't find useful. So they're only leaving the little pieces that they need, maybe to make a protein or develop a drug treatment. And because of that manipulation, because they're changing it, they said that is a man-made invention, and that is patentable in most cases.
So your special blend of, you know, X gene could be patented. The test itself, though, can Myriad Genetics continue to enforce a patent on its test of those two genes?
Yeah, so a lot of other genetic testing labs, you know, like Myriad, were very, very excited yesterday because they haven't really been able to offer the test that Myriad has been able to offer on the BRCA1 and 2 genes. Now, Myriad still kind of holds other patents related to this test. And so I think what we're really going to figure out is, you know, what part of it do they still retain? You know, they kind of released a statement yesterday saying, hey, we still have other patents. We still feel good about this decision. They were saving face a little bit, I think. But other labs will actually have the opportunity now to offer this test.
That is, unless Myriad Genetics attempts to find out where the legal dividing line is in each of those cases.
Yeah, and what's also interesting is that because Myriad's been doing this test for a very long time, they have a really big database of information. You know, they have a lot of different results, and those are results you need to kind of figure out, well, what mutations actually cause what? You know, a lot of data is very helpful. So I think the case that they'll be making is, well, we're still the best place to get this test because we have this kind of database that we can use to inform what your results are.
Mildred Cho, is biotechnology or biomedical technology unusual in the sense that there seems to be all this dark matter locked away behind corporate vaults, corporate legal ability to say, you can't have our information? So for the researcher, there are things you know and things you don't know.
Well, I don't think it's unique because a lot of the research on DNA and in discoveries about DNA, especially those coming out of academia, have gone into publicly accessible databases, and there's been a very strong push to do that. So there's a large amount of information that is available publicly. But I do think that especially genetic diagnostic tests may be a little bit different from other kinds of technologies in terms of how patents affect them, because this kind of technology really uses DNA as information as opposed to as chemicals. And I think that patent law may really not be very well suited to covering information-based technologies.
We've heard this complaint a lot. Where do you see the conversation going after this ruling?
Well, I think in a lot of ways the technologies that we have for sequencing DNA and analyzing it have in some ways moved beyond the Myriad patents and made them a little bit less relevant because now we can do whole genome sequencing. We can analyze DNA directly without having to use cDNAs specifically, which are the things that are still covered in by the as a result of this decision. So, in some ways, I think companies that were relying on or wanting to use whole genome sequencing and analyzing many genes all at the same time can just move on without fear of patent litigation.
We're talking about gene patenting this half hour. We'll take, as we talk, we'd like to hear from listeners. Do you own a gene patent? What are your concerns going forward? Join the conversation, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. Maybe you're a healthcare patient who is concerned about how the law and biomedicine intersect with your life personally. Go to our website, kqed.org/forum, post your comments online. Lauren Sommer, what is your sense of what companies will be doing or won't be doing in the next few weeks, sort of reacting to the ruling?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of biotech companies, you know, and certainly the Bay Area is a huge hub for biotech. They weren't really commenting yesterday. They're kind of, I think, sorting through this decision, really seeing what the impact will be. You know, it's certainly a big change for them. I mean, 30 years now, the entire industry has kind of been based on this idea that you can patent a human gene. But because the ruling really only focused on this kind of more narrow part of what's patentable and not, you know, a lot of companies like Genentech yesterday were saying, well, we're not too concerned about this decision. I mean, I think there's a lot to shake out in the weeks ahead, but that's what they're saying now.
You are hearing from companies in San Diego. They seem to be sort of tentatively positive about it. Myriad stock went up 10%. Maybe folks on Wall Street know something we don't. It does seem, as Mildred Cho pointed out, that the science has kind of moved beyond this point. I mean, naturally, breast cancer genes are of immense interest to people who are researching it and, you know, worried about having breast cancer. But really, when you look at the larger body of science, we've stopped seeing genes as sort of like light switches that go on and off and refer directly to one, you know, currently social interest.
Yeah, and I think the myriad patents, you know, as Mildred mentions, were kind of these very broad early patents for these isolated genes. It gave you kind of this very blanket power. You know, patents that have been written more recently just aren't quite written like that anymore. But I think it is a really good point that we aren't really thinking about one gene, one disease anymore. We're thinking about, you know, broader genome questions. How do genes relate to each other? So this does actually free up a little bit more of that work to kind of start looking at the direction that medicine is really going.
We're already getting phone calls. You can join the conversation as well, 866-733-6786. Why don't we turn now to Chanel in Berkeley?
Hi there. I have a question regarding Myriad's database that they have. I'm wondering how much of that is kept as a company secret, how much of that has been published and would be useful to up-and-coming companies who would like to perform this test.
Yeah, a lot of that was published by Myriad in the early days, and then at some point they stopped releasing that information publicly. You know, this is the database of information about, you know, what mutations, what diseases do they think those cause, or how does that influence your risk of getting a certain type of cancer? And so that was not affected by this decision. That's kind of their intellectual property. And a lot of people are really concerned about that. You know, that's been one of the flags people have raised, is that, well, because that's secret, no one can really check, right? Nobody really knows how they're interpreting kind of certain test results. So, I mean, there's, you know, at UCSF, there's one professor there who's trying to start and gather his own database of information because he thinks that it should be publicly available, widely available. So that question, I think, still needs to be answered.
It seems one that was very much on the minds of the Supreme Court justices. Stephen Breyer said at some point during the arguments, on the one hand, we do want people to invent. On the other hand, we're very worried about them tying up some kind of whatever it is, particularly a thing that itself could be used for further advance. There seems to be this conflicting dynamic. On the one hand, it's the enticement of profits that lead people forward. But on the other hand, that very thing could lock up science that's powerfully important for all of us. Mildred Cho, what do you hear people saying about this?
Well, I think the database issue is very important. But I also think it's important to point out that, for example, in studies that we did and that have been confirmed by others, that the majority of gene-based patents or claims on DNA sequence were the result of federally funded research. So when we looked in the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office database for gene patents, we found that two-thirds of those patents had federal funding behind them. So, you know, I think some people have talked about the risk of invention and how patents are necessary to protect those. But I think if you really look behind the patents, a lot of that research is being done and a lot of the risk is being absorbed by the taxpayer-funded studies. So I don't think that's going to change now as a result of this.
Lauren Sommer, you've reported in the past that's particularly true here in California with the UC system.
Yeah, UCSF holds a lot of gene patents. You know, a lot of biotech companies have spun out of that research that happened right here in the Bay Area. So, you know, even UCSF, actually, you know, they're affected by this decision as well because they hold patents and license them.
Is it the sort of thing where maybe now they're looking at early steps in this arena and saying, maybe we shouldn't favor one company. Maybe we should try to set up those contracts so that we spread the wealth a little bit?
Yes. And that's been something that the UC system and other universities have been very conscious of. You know, they don't want to develop a lot of these kind of, you know, this research and then lock it up in one company with one licensing agreement. So much more recently, they've been a lot more careful to write really broad licenses and to kind of spread it around a little bit more.
Well, let's head back to the phones. We've got Karuna in San Francisco.
Hi, thank you so much for covering the story. It's such an important story. And Breast Cancer Action is a plaintiff on the case. We're the only breast cancer organization represented. And I want to just say that this is an unmediated win for patients. This is an absolutely landmark case immediately, and we have seen already labs have come out offering new tests, better tests at lower costs, So immediately more women are going to have access to this vitally important and potentially life-saving information about their inherited risk of breast and ovarian cancer. For the first time, women who are considering their medical options have access to second opinions. This is so important for women who are considering removing healthy organs, as well as for women who have received an ambiguous result from Myriad's test. In essence, Myriad has told them, you have a mutation and we don't know whether it's linked to cancer. And beyond breast cancer, for all of us, this ruling opens the door to research and treatment for all hereditary diseases without the fear of patent infringement, without fear that, you know, a lab will be shut down while they're, you know, conducting vital and essential research and innovation into progress on health. So I just want to say that this is a tremendously important ruling. I also want to note that, you know, on this question of cDNA, while it is true that Myriad's stock began, you know, began the day high, at the end of the day, Myriad's stock was down. And what we saw was a roller coaster as the market responded to what is essentially Myriad's spin. I don't believe that the ruling is anything like as favorable to Myriad's patents as they have been claiming. I think that the court's ruling on cDNA is, in fact, a much more modest ruling than Myriad has claimed. And at the end of the day, it does not diminish the impact for patients because, as your speakers have noted, laboratories can and do conduct genetic testing without using the cDNA. And what this means for women is that Myriad no longer holds a monopoly on these BRCA genes, on our human genes. Their patent was so sweeping that they owned all naturally occurring variations and mutations of these human genes. So this is a tremendous win for patients and for people everywhere.
Karuna, thank you for calling in. Mildred Cho, you know, she raises a point that you've raised just a few minutes ago about the sort of uneasy boundary line between our patent tradition and the new science of biomedicine. The U.S. Patent Office has been granting patents on DNA sequences for 30 years now. Oftentimes it seems locking in, 20-year monopolies on things that it doesn't really fully understand.
Well, I agree with the caller that this is this sort of unlocking is really important because in that 20 years, think about how much has changed in the technology of DNA analysis. And one of the problems with locking in with a sole source provider of a genetic test is that other laboratories are not able to improve on those tests using perhaps better technologies than what Myriad had. And we know that DNA sequencing quality varies a lot from platform to platform. And if one company is allowed to be the only one that's providing it, we don't know if they're using the best technology or the most accurate, doing the most accurate testing. And 20 years is a long time. So I think this is really important in allowing other labs to jump in and perhaps vastly improve the quality of some of this testing. In one of the studies that we did, we found that as a result of getting a cease and desist letter from a patent holder, genetic testing labs, about half of them decided not to try to develop a new test or improve an existing test. So I think that sort of stopping this process of having the patents being enforced could potentially open up a lot of activity that will improve the clinical quality of testing.
It's worth noting, I mean, even though people who've been waiting on this test are, you know, distressed, enraged about Myriad and its suing practices are celebrating today, Myriad had many years in which to keep this particular part of science locked down. Do you see another company, another particular kind of situation where somebody is holding the line and it may take 15 years to get to the next U.S. Supreme Court decision?
Well, I mean, I think that the effect of this decision is much more broad than just the BRCA1 and BRCA2 gene patents. It really applies to the general notion of what is patentable and what is not patentable. So I think that this could unlock a lot of different the ability of companies to compete much more broadly on genetic testing services.
Where do you see this going, Lauren Sommer? Where do you see this sort of uneasy boundary line between law and science?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I mean, it's particularly one for the Bay Area, right? I mean, software, it's a great example of, well, how do you patent information, right? How do you patent this thing, a DNA sequence? They're patenting the information. It's not a methodology thing. It's literally the information. So, I mean, I think there are questions that we're still going to be sorting out. You know, one thing that has been brought up in this case is that, you know, even though the synthetic DNA, you know, is protected based on this ruling, it seems like the court left the door open a little bit, because in order to patent something, you have to show that your invention isn't obvious. And so what a lot of people have been talking about in the last day is, well, maybe synthetic DNA isn't completely protected, because if you could make the case that what they did was a very obvious thing to do, maybe it isn't really patent eligible. So I think the discussion is really going to continue on those lines.
Let's turn back to the phones. We have John in Dublin.
Hi, yes. You actually just touched on what I was going to talk about, how the current patent system really doesn't, it's really untenable for the rapidly changing technological environment. You know, Apple tries to claim a patent on rectangular cell phones, and you know, people are patenting, you know, human genes that have been around for, you know, at least, you know, 5,000 years. Obviously the stock market's thrilled that the cDNA has been upheld as patentable because, you know, that, you know, it does represent some degree of work. But, work should be rewarded, but, I think in general, the entire patent system has to be, you know, rethought out because...
Reimagined, you know,
reimagined, maybe even just, I wouldn't say done away with, but maybe take everything on more of a case-by-case basis because, you know, the rapidly progressing technological environment is making it impossible to really realistically regulate. You just get a bunch of, large entities like Monsanto and Apple that are just
Lauren Sommer, I mean, you know, there's there have long been complaints. There is seminar after symposium after seminar about what's wrong with the patent system, either from the high-tech point of view or the biotech point of view. Is there any sign that this is going to be a priority for Congress?
I mean, what we have heard rumblings of is kind of the patent troll question, right? That's where somebody is buying up patents and then suing people for infringing on them. You know, there have been some rumblings about that. I mean, an overall patent system makeover, I mean, I think it's still a very open issue right now.
And there are a number of things in between now and then. Mildred Cho, any thoughts on your side?
Well, I mean, I think it's unlikely we're going to have drastic changes to the patent system right now. But I think one thing to think about is that in other countries, they do evaluate patents in the courts in a different manner. And I think one thing you could see in looking at the decision for this particular case was how much the court struggled with the scientific issues. Other countries have a different method where they have people that have scientific or technical expertise that are making decisions about patents. So that's potentially another model to use.
Well, thank you so much, Mildred Cho, Associate Director for the Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics and a professor in Stanford's Department of Pediatrics. Thank you also, Lauren Sommer, Science and Environment Reporter for KQED Public Radio. We've been talking about gene patenting in light of yesterday's U.S. Supreme Court decision. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Myrow.